Hi, my name is Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. And, well, I want to thank Sherry and Diane for inviting me to come here this year, and Pat for, and I just had Jim and Dorothy for picking us up at the airport, and Sarah for schlepping my family back to back here. And there are a lot of people I know. I've known a lot of people here for, or it's not a lot, I shouldn't say that. A lot of people that have meant a lot to me in my sobriety are here today, Sharon and Casey and Marty and, I thought I've already done bad. I was listening to Sarah read the end of A Vision for You, and it says, you can't transmit something you haven't gotten. All I'm thinking is, I haven't slept right. I'm not getting enough oxygen. I've had 9 cups of coffee. What in the hell am I transmitting anyway? I could make those lights blink on and off right now, I think. Some of our friends from Los Angeles have trekked in. This is fun. I'm thankful to my wife for having my children tonight and taking them up to the room, and they were kind of tired, so she said, well, I'll stay with them, and just as long as you mention me. and then she said, and I'm buying the tape. So, thank you, Louise. Wonderful, beautiful woman you. We've been married for 6 months now, so anyway. Any questions? I'm trying to think of exactly what I want to transmit right now. I'm an alcoholic. I have no outside issues. Pretty much begins and ends there. I've heard a lot of outside issues in Los Angeles. You hear them every so often. And I'm afraid I don't have anything more exciting to say than I'm an alcoholic. And I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that if any of my children or your children have trouble with alcohol years from now, I hope they find the Alcoholics Anonymous that I found. Because as I heard an Al-Anon speaker say one time, he said that the first generation of any kind of an enterprise comes in and founds it on hard work and fear and trepidation and uncertainty. And then the second generation grows it and flowers it and spreads it around and makes it huge and successful. And the third generation squanders the fortune. And I'm in the third generation, and I don't want to see that fortune squandered for the next one. So it's incumbent upon, and I'm not saying this is nobility, believe me. There are some times when you pick up the phone and go, oh, please don't ask me to talk anywhere. I just don't think I can do it. I don't want to take my clothes off at the airport again. Just for the sake of the other passengers, you know. But it's incumbent upon people in AA to be present for AA and to keep the primary purpose focused, and that's why I'm just an alcoholic. I'm Pete and Katie's boy. I have nothing of notoriety about me. My parents were, my dad was a Minnesota farm boy with about a fourth grade education, and my mom was a lady from Massachusetts with about a seventh grade education. She had to quit school and start working in the Depression during the Depression, and I was I was their only child. My mom had 4 full-term pregnancies, and 3 of them died at birth. And I was the one that survived. And don't think I didn't feel a little bit of responsibility being the lone survivor after being told I was the lone one for a long time. I didn't feel like I had any sense of duty. I just felt like, why me? Why? Because I didn't ask to be born. I don't like people. Present company excluded, but it's them that are the irritation. And I was walking around today with kind of trying to catch my breath and thinking, looking for someone that would be acceptable if I had to have CPR. And I was trying to stand next to people that were at least attractive. So I just, So I just haven't liked people, and I have a problem with that too, because as most alcoholics that I know, I loathe the human race. I wonder sometimes how it ever got into a second generation. But I also demand its approval and adoration at the same time, which gives you a real sense of torque in your life. It really does keep you moving forward. And why do I have... There's a fly sitting on my hand. Is there anyone from PETA here? Don't worry, if he was on my hand, he was old and infirm and ready to go. Anyway, God, I forgot where I was, and now I'm just going to have to start all over. I was uncomfortable most of my life as a child. I was just out of sorts. I was a rebel. I didn't tell anybody. I was just not happy at all. I remember experiencing joy as a child, but I don't remember where. And I remember after being about age 8, I found it harder and harder to experience any kind of joy. I didn't know why. I didn't understand what it was. I didn't understand why. I was always weighing my response to everybody, trying to see how I could fit in and not attract too much attention and yet still be a part of things that I didn't understand. I didn't like it. And when I was about... ever since I've been in school, I've been told about my potential, which is, according to my family, is legendary. Not understanding, of course, that they don't tell people who are using their potential that they have it. This is something that they only tell people like us. That, you know, they would sit. I remember sitting in offices with my parents, you know, and some counselor or teacher or priest or somebody with a big folder, and they would look at it and they would shut it after a second and go, you know, Charles has potential. We just don't understand why he doesn't do anything with it. And my response was always the same, and that was, you know, I know I've got potential. My parents now know I've got potential. Thank you so much. You know I've got potential. It seems like all God's children know I've got potential. And I will use my potential when I'm goddamn good and ready to. But I'm not going to use it even that much sooner, you know. When I do use my potential, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Skippy, because I'm going to light you up. But until then, maybe you can take your really pathetic concern for my potential and go wipe it on some other sap, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor now, would you? It never came out in exactly those words. It usually said something like, I'll try harder. But that's pretty much the story of my life right there. That you can... You just add alcohol to that and you've got my story, pretty much. I got out of high school with no notoriety. I was launched into the music industry. I was a clerk at a record store, and I was working there. I'm a big... Well, I started college when I was 17, which sounds impressive until you realize I graduated when I was 30. So I had a lot of detours in my life, so to speak. But so I was going to college, you know, one unit, and then working at this record store, and these guys came in and they asked me if I wanted to go to a party, which was shocking to me because no one had ever... I wasn't a mingler. I didn't like parties. I'd never really been to a party before, and I was stunned by it because, as I understood it, there would be, you know, other people at the party. And here I was, 18, and I hadn't been to a party yet, so I said, okay, so I'll go. And I got my friend John, my lone friend, and we trotted over to this party in Santa Ana, California, in this nice big Victorian house that somebody apparently didn't want to keep in its original state. And there were about 200 kids there, and it was 1968. Sharon, Casey will remember, they had a mirror ball in there. Before, it wasn't disco, it was pre-disco mirror ball. They were playing the MC5 on the stereo. Half the room was just blazed on acid, and the other half of the room was drunk, and they all thought they were communicating. And everybody was talking in that irritating 1968 BS hippy-dippy jargon that they got from Philosophy 101, that, you know, and all that hipster bull, that just a bunch of phonies is what they were. The whole house full of them. You know, they're all hip and they're all cool and they're all groovy and everybody's having a great time. Everybody's into the music and they really understand the music and they're deep in the music and the girls are dancing like Joni Mitchell would dance if she was there. And it was, I was standing off to the corner. This is 5 minutes into the party and I was livid. And I thought to myself, why did I agree to come to this thing? I hate these people. This is an exact, and I don't know if anybody else follows me, but how many of you can be irritated with somebody like on the, well, I don't have to name a specific place. Of course, you can be irritated with anybody pretty much anywhere. But somebody on the freeway will do something that just gets, just, even after the serenity prayer, just gets so under your skin that it's almost something, it almost reignites some atavistic reptilian memory in the back of your head. And you see them not as a human being, but you, it all of a sudden is just like, they fill out the entire matrix of what's wrong with the world. That guy. I'm not pointing at you. I'm just saying it's that guy. That's him. All right, everybody, get him. So that's how I was at that party. I'm looking at these people, and it just seemed like this is exactly why the world is falling apart. People like this, they're ridiculous. They're horrifying. And then somebody walked by and said, you want something to drink? And I thought, oh yeah, I'd love something to drink, you know, but I'm not, I don't want to be like you. This is idiotic. Well, he handed me a can of malt liquor and walked on. So I got this can of malt liquor and I figure I'm not going to get anything else, you know. So I popped the thing open and started drinking it. And about halfway through that can of malt liquor, it occurred to me that I've been way too hard on you people. Halfway through that can of malt liquor, I started to feel different. I started to feel like a hybrid of John Lennon and Errol Flynn and David Niven, all kind of swirled around in this great magnetic concoction, which is almost impossible to pull off when you look like Sherman from the Mr. Peabody cartoons. At the time, I was as tall as I am now, 127 pounds, and I looked like a pair of scissors. I had big wire-rimmed glasses on, you know, but I just started to feel different. I started to feel like people in this room who are alcoholic understand what alcohol does to make you feel different. I felt, the only way I know how to describe this, forgive me, my friends, who've heard this 1,000 times before. The only way I can describe how it made me feel was for the first time in my life, I felt like I was right there. I was there in that moment with everybody else. We were all in the same moment together instead of me looking through some film that kept me separate from everybody else. That it's not even like a brick wall. It's just the stuff that whenever I tried to push on it, it seems like it moved with me and I couldn't get to the other side of it. And when I drank, it just disappeared. And I was part of everybody. And I was fond of you. And I wanted to listen to you. I could listen to you all night. I was just delighted because I'd lost the ability to speak after about 4 months. But I was so delighted to be there. I thought I just, you know, and it wasn't like if you're new, and there are probably a couple of new people in the room. I know there's one that identified himself. I didn't have this revelation in real time. It did. I wasn't standing there thinking, "Wow, this is really going to be a great way to explain this when I get sober." The only reason anybody in AA who's speaking here knows about what happened is that we've all been to a lot of AA meetings. We've all done a lot of steps. We've all worked with a lot of people, and we've all taken direction from a merciless sponsor, and we've heard a lot of different stories. And so, by having people share their stories with us in this fellowship, I've started to understand what happened to me based on what happened to other people. I saw some of the similarities and some of the differences, and began to understand that. But for my recollection tonight, I just felt completely electrified when I started drinking, and it wasn't so obvious. It was like Sharon talked about it. I went into a blackout that night. I wound up hanging on to my friend John's door handle because he wanted to go home. And I was hanging on to the door handle, jogging alongside of his car and vomiting on myself and laughing my ass off because I had been to the mountaintop, you know. I had seen the other side. And I was, and I'll tell you something really, something so strange when you think about it, if you think about your own lives. I never was the same from that moment that I drank that first can of malt liquor. I've never been able to be the same person ever again. And I think it really is helpful to remember that, because only alcoholics understand what's at stake when I drink. You know, we know what's at stake with each other. When I talk to another alcoholic, if I'm going through something, and you may hate my guts already, I'm only like 15 minutes into this, and you may wish that I did need CPR, but but I'll tell you one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is that if I was having trouble staying sober tonight, and I called you at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, "This is Charlie, I was at the meeting tonight, and I'm having trouble staying sober," there isn't a single person in this room that wouldn't meet me in the lobby to talk to me about it. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. We set aside every difference we have to go in and share parts of our story to try to mitigate the feelings that an alcoholic has when the world is crushing in on us. Because it's not just that I sit and crave alcohol when I'm sober. It's that the world bugs me. And sometimes it's not even in catastrophic ways. I mean, I can handle catastrophe. I can handle all the stuff that's on my insurance policy. I can handle all that. What I can't handle is that little slight that people make, or feeling stupid in front of other people, or being made to feel stupid in front of somebody else, or doing something really bad and trying to cover up for it, and the guilt that hangs in there with it. That's the stuff that makes me feel like I need a drink, because I know that if I have a couple ounces of bourbon, I'm going to feel really fine. I'm going to feel now like I'm there, like I'm in the moment that is the window to the future, and all that other stuff won't matter. You know, it doesn't matter anymore. I have what I need. Alcohol gave me for a lot of years the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a damn thing. I sense there are some people who have experienced that feeling. You got a deadline, you got to do something, it's in front of you, you have to do it. You have to do it. And I am going to do it, you know, in a minute. I'll give you an example of my, just to kind of, because I have the most boring drunkologue in AA, and my friends will attest to that. I have never come out of a blackout saying, you know, yelling, "Cover me, I'm going in." I've never come out of a blackout saying, "Okay, cut the red wire," or, you know, "Keep going, men, the summit's just ahead." I've come out of blackouts with people saying stuff to me like, "Boy, I bet that hurt." Because that's just, I'm just not a very, I'm a vigorous alcoholic, I'm just not a very dramatic one. I write for a living, and I actually do. I used to say that, but I really do. And on the side, I'm an astronaut. But I was writing about, I was writing a story, and it required knowledge of weapons. And you can take one look at me and know that my handgun days are ahead of me. And so I was doing some research, and it was reading about handguns and the velocity of a bullet coming out of the barrel of a handgun, and that a bullet comes out of the barrel of a handgun. Now, please, I'm going to say this, but please don't correct me later if you're a handgun guy. I know I might be wrong a little bit, but please, you'll scare me. But a bullet comes out of the barrel of a handgun at 450 feet per second, which by anybody's standards is a wallop. 450 feet per second, 450 feet away. It's like that. But if you fire a handgun into a body of water, it still comes out of the barrel at 450 feet per second. It strikes the surface of the water, and then it goes in a little bit further, still 450 feet per second, then it stops, and it just drifts to the bottom of whatever the body of water is. Such is the trajectory of my life. I come out of the barrel at 450 feet per second. In any relationship, assignment, job, anything I need to do, I'm 450 feet per second. Kaboom! The firing pins ignite. Pow! I just come out of the barrel blazing. But somehow, at some point, I hit the surface of the water, And I keep going a little bit and then just drift harmlessly to the bottom of the pool. And the water's just fear. And I've lived with fear, like a suffocating fear, all my life, and I got so used to living with it that I didn't even know it was there. So I masked my ungenuine nature with false stuff in the front. There are a lot of tough guys in AA that are masking fear with their false bravado. There are a lot of us phony intellectuals in AA. You know, the guys with big foreheads and glasses that are trying to fob it off like you've got some kind of knowledge that we don't have. And there are a lot of people, we come in here with this mask that we wear, and I that was all I had, really, and to hide the fear, to hold back the fear. And so I drank through the next 12 years. I drank just like I drank that night at that party. I've come out of blackouts. You know, I'm the kind of guy that they hold mirrors under my nose when I'm drinking, you know, just to see if I'm still there. It was actually, at first it wasn't bad. You know, it's kind of fun. You know, when you first start drinking, you start having blackouts, and they're not really bad. I was standing at a party in Long Beach one time, saying hello to people, and all of a sudden, Santa Monica, you know, and with my car keys in my hand going, wow, this is like molecular transport, you know? Long Beach, Santa Monica, reassemble. The only problem was that was the only time that it was that convenient. I was thinking in my head I could shave travel time, just clear it out, but it didn't work out that way. But I drank to the point where people throw me in the back of a pickup truck and drive me down a railroad track to try to wake me up. I just like the way it makes me feel. It makes me feel different. It makes me feel whole. It makes me feel like there's a future that I can see and experience that I don't see and experience when I'm sober. It makes, and this sounds like a harsh word. It sounds like an overly dramatic word too, but I don't think it is. When you think about it, as little tiny bits expressed over a long period of time with a deepening concentration, it's suffering. It helps to alleviate the suffering that I would feel that day with some false sense of hope, but the suffering gets filed away, and the suffering gets pushed down, and the suffering gets refiled and rejigged, and it always leaks out somewhere. It always, the anger and the frustration and the contempt for people and the contempt for life and the sense of why bother? Why bother with this? Why do I even need this crap? You know, and I was confounded by my own ineptitude at how to do things. I couldn't get through college. I couldn't get through anything. And it was all because when I'd start doing it, I'd get a whiff of my own fear and back away and run to the safest thing, you know, run to the thing that was the most safe. And so for years I went on doing that. I got sicker and sicker. I drank more and more. And I got married thinking that by having a spouse that would complete me as a person, which sounds very, very romantic when you think about it in terms of poetry, that, you know, one and one make one. If one and one make one, you're pathetic. For me to look for another person to complete me is, ew, it's creepy. Especially when you know me, because I defy completion. And I would drink and I would get there, you know, and I got married. I married this lovely woman who, you know, we were both about 25, and she was just a delightful human being. Her only problem was she loved me, and I loved her too as much as I thought I could. Until I'm really good with relationships. I mean, really good with advice on relationships till another person isn't introduced into the relationship, and I kind of fold. But I loved this woman the best I could. But you know, on our honeymoon, we'd go back to our room after dinner, and I would tuck her into bed, and then I'd go out and drink. I just go out to the, and drink. I didn't think that was there was anything wrong with that. I need to express what's. I was so afraid of being a husband, I guess, that I just had to go out and pretend I was something else, pretend I was a grown-up, pretend I was a real guy, you know, and it was nonsense. It was just rubbish. And I didn't know that at the time, and I hurt that woman terribly. And we wound up getting a divorce about 5 years later, and she got me to go into therapy, which was really, really helpful. I'm not knocking therapy. I think therapy is really helpful for a lot of people, but it didn't work on my alcoholism. You know, I wasn't neurotic. I wasn't. I heard someone speak to the other night. I wanted to talk to him about what he said. But I used to have. I had a therapist who would ask me about my dreams, and he really liked them, and he started writing them down. And he started. He said, "You have the most non-neurotic dreams I've ever heard." And then he stopped charging me for sessions. He just had me come in and tell him about my dreams. And I started to feel so guilty about not having a good dream to tell him. I'd make him up, you know. And that's just the way it was. And therapy was not helpful at that point for my alcoholism. I saw this woman therapist for a while. And she told me one time, if you ever come in here smelling of alcohol again, I'm not going to treat you anymore. And that was my first alert that it was bothersome to somebody. And I had this wife who would constantly say things like, "We're going to have dinner soon. Why are you drinking? Or didn't you just have one?" These questions that really, they're so. How do you answer a question like that? "I know I just had one. Now I just had a breath too. I think I'm going to take another one. Why don't you go in the next room and take three or four?" And this woman, her brother Bob was a terrible alcoholic, but he drank like I did, you know. And he came over to our house one time. It was one of the first times, probably the second time I met him. And he came over to our house, and Bob and I started drinking, and we were having a great time with the stereo going and talking the talk and everything. And I look over, and there's my wife giving me one of these. Now, men know that this does not mean I want to call you in and compliment you on something. So she calls me into the bedroom. I go in there, and she says, with tears in her eyes, she goes, Bob had been in hospitals in rehab. There weren't that many rehabs in the early 1970s in that area for alcoholism. But he had been in rehabs and hospitals and all that stuff for drinking. And she said, "Stop giving Bob alcohol. Bob is an alcoholic." And I looked at her and said, with a straight face, "Bob is no more of an alcoholic than I am. The problem here is you are a nag. Now, why don't you just back it up, sister, and let us have a little fun? Shut the door." I could hear her sobbing in there, so we just turned the stereo up, and we had a great time. The 2 weeks later, Bob was dead, and he drowned. And he was drunk one day, went up to Lake Castaic, went into the water, and they had to have a boat go out the next morning with police on it and drag the lake to find him. And no one mentioned alcoholism then. You know, I certainly didn't want to hear about it. He just had a bad swimming accident, you know, and no one said a word about it. And he had a 5-year-old daughter and a wife, and it was a bad scene. He was 25 years old. And I just went along like, you know, I went up and picked up his car with all his belongings in it where he had died and drove it back and didn't say a word about it. You know, that didn't stop me a bit. In June of 1981, actually in May of 1981, my wife wanted a divorce, and I was distraught. You know, I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, and the therapy was going lousy, and everything. I was peeing blood, and I couldn't tell anybody because you can't, you know, that, you just can't say. People are going, "How you doing?" "Oh, I just peeing a little blood, but other than that, I'm fine." You know, my skin was falling off. I was sweeping out my bed in the morning. It was like I was decomposing and I'm still alive kind of thing. And I was having a lot of physical problems. Most of all, I just could not stop drinking, and I wasn't trying to stop drinking. Drinking was the last thing that was my problem, since drinking intermittently made me feel like it did that night in 1968 where I felt like I was there. Well, it still made me feel there for a while, but it was just something was beating the hell out of me, and I didn't understand what it was, and that's why I was in therapy. And that wasn't you know, it wasn't getting to the problem. And so she suggested that I join this group that was going up to have a meditation weekend up in Montecito, which is just south of Santa Barbara. And I thought, oh, great, you know, a meditation weekend. Yeah, that'll help. I'll go on this. I'll get some spirituality, and then I won't feel so bad. So I go up there, and I stopped to get something to eat on the way up there, and the woman in the restaurant said, would you like a glass of wine or something, a drink with that? And I'd been drunk the night before, and I said, you know, because I knew there'd be wine up at the meditation retreat. So I said, no, not right now. I don't want to get pulled over and all that jazz. I've been pulled over too many times. Okay, so I go up to the meditation retreat. I get up there. About 80 people show up about the same time I do. I'm parked in there, and I go up to the where they're having the meeting, and she said, can I get you something to drink? I thought, now you're talking. Yeah, I'll have a glass of burgundy if you got it. And she laughed. She laughed. And she said, oh, we don't have any alcohol here. And I thought, this is a Catholic retreat center, right? If not you, who would have wine? I mean, she goes, oh, no, we don't have alcohol at these things. Would you like some herb tea? And I thought, no, I don't want any herb tea. Perhaps you could chop up some regular tea and I could sniff it or something, you know? Something with a little, that's going to give me a little, that's going to get me perking, but not, no, I don't want, I couldn't say that. I said, oh, really? And I look out the window and there's, you know, 80 cars behind my car because it was stacked parking. I couldn't get out. And I started sobering up that night against my better judgment. And I thought, I can do this. I'll be all right. I can do this. It's like lack of oxygen. I can handle this. And the next day and the next morning, we had a guided meditation in this room. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to therapy where you have the guided meditation where they play the lute music and a little flute in the background. And we're lying on the floor in this room. And she said, okay, you're walking through a field. You know, she took us all through this scenario. You're walking through a field, and now you get through the meadow, and you can feel the grass under your feet. And you get to a waterfall, and you can see the water coming down the waterfall. And you step up to the waterfall, and you step into the water, and it cleanses you. And the water turns blue, and it washes away your sorrow. And the water turns green, and it washes away your jealousy. And the water turns red, and it washes away your anger. And we went through like the entire Sherwin-Williams catalog. And the water turns Swiss coffee. And all I'm thinking the entire time is, I have got to get out of here. I can't stand this. I'm laying on this floor. I can feel the shag carpet coming up through my shirt. And I know everybody, we were laying like spokes on a wheel around in this room. And I know everybody else was into it. And I just was going, I was out of my mind. I thought, no, no. And she goes, now I want you to step out of the back from the water. And I want you to look at the waterfall. And I want you to look through the water. You can see through it. And through that water, you can see where you're going to be 5 years from today. Take a look at your life. And I, for a split second, I looked through that damn waterfall, and I saw myself hanging from my bathroom door at home with the cord from my robe around my neck, dead. Now, I don't know what anybody else was thinking or seeing in the waterfall. Something tells me there might have been children or jobs and stuff. And then she said after it was all over, and I saw that, and it just struck me. It horrified me, but it horrified me, and I was resigned to it at the same time. And I believe today, I believe that was a moment of clarity. Just a moment where, yeah, this is where you're going to be in 5 years. I was hitting it pretty hard, and I saw that and thought, oh, man, no, I can't do that. You know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And she let us leave there, and she goes, now, for the next five, this is what every alcoholic likes to hear, for the next 5 hours, I want you to look at your life and see how you can reach the vision you saw in the water. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I got a better idea. I'm going to put my face right down by the bumper of your car and you floor it. I went out on the grounds, the beautiful grounds at this retreat house, and was wandering around out there, and I sat down and I thought, this is all there is. I just should die. And I didn't want any drama. It wasn't dramatic. It wasn't self-pitying at all. It was a real thought that maybe that is the solution to the way I feel right now. I think somewhere in the big book, because I can't quote the big book. I know the big book. I understand the big book. I read the big book, but I can't quote it. And I apologize if you want to hear quotations from the big book. But there is a part in the big book that says something about alcoholics who don't take care of the problem, wind up taking drastic measures, the ultimate choice of dying, I believe it is, or something to that effect. And I thought to myself at that point, I just want to be lifted out of this life. I just want to be plucked out of here. I don't want to have any drama. I mean, I've already had the drama about dying. If you're new or even not new and you have ever written your Academy Award acceptance speech and your funeral plans in the same afternoon, welcome to AA. I bounce like that too. But at that moment I thought, I just want to leave this world because I didn't mean to be the person I am. I know my parents had better things in mind for me, and I didn't have any connection with my parents. I disengaged my friends. I disengaged everybody. You hear people sometimes coming into AA and go, nobody liked me anymore, but I just cut everybody loose. It was hard to tell if anybody liked me anymore. I was just disconnecting all my friendships and disconnecting everything in order to drink and be the person that I felt I had to be, and I was alone, and I thought, just take me out of here. And at the moment I felt that sense of despair, I felt a concurrent sense that I was completely loved to the bottom of my soul, and I didn't know where that came from. I felt completely bathed in some kind of love for about 30 seconds sitting there, and when it evaporated, I thought, I've really gone crazy now. I'm really crazy. I've really lost my mind. And I walked around that place in shell shock. I cried for about the next 10 hours. And then I just left there later. I left the next morning. I just went up to the bunk area where I was sleeping, and I just slept. And I left the next day, and I drove home. And that day was the 11th of June of 1981, and that was the day I took my last drink, and I've taken anything since then. And I got home, and I thought of stopping at the market. So I stopped there, and I didn't buy booze. I bought popsicles. I don't know why. I went home and started eating popsicles you know how alcoholics do anything. I'm going through a box of popsicles like a seagull in a bait shop. I'm just, I'm going through them. And every half hour, I'd go in and barf up this melted rainbow and stare at it and go back out and do some more. And I was detoxing big time. And I detox the old-fashioned way at work, and hate to disappoint anybody. I didn't go through rehab. I didn't find out what the 38th chromosome that controls alcoholism is. All I knew is that I needed a drink right then, and then if I drank, I would wind up like I saw in that waterfall, and I can't kill myself, so I'm stuck. Now what? If you ever reach that now what position, you're in a good place, because I heard Gene Duffy talk. Gene was an old-time AA member who was, he was a great guy. And he said one time at a meeting that I heard him speak at, he said there's a point in every alcoholic's life where they're sitting at the bar and they're looking at a glass of whiskey and they're thinking, if I drink this, I'm going to die. And if I don't drink this, I'm not going to live. I can't live. Now what? And I had reached that sense of desperation. I didn't bring it on. And I'll tell you something. A lot of the times what keeps me from drinking even now is the sense and the belief that I could not recreate the sequence of events that happened to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. You know, I came into AA by accident. I walked into AA. What happened was I went 4 days without a drink. And I told my mother-in-law that I quit drinking that week. You know, I'm doing really well. You know, phone's hammering against my glasses while I'm talking to her. And I was hearing Steely Dan playing in the back seat of my car and my stereo. And the stereo hadn't been hooked up for years. And that didn't stop me. I was like, Asia. And I kept hearing people in the back seat calling my name. And I kept getting the imaginary gnats that congregate in your peripheral vision that kind of hang there while you're talking to people. And you eventually have to turn to look at them. And they go away until you go back to who you're talking to, and they're right back again. And so all I knew to do was this, you know. And my mother-in-law called me and said, Debbie was my sister-in-law. Debbie needs a ride to an AA meeting. She just got out of the care unit down in Orange, and she needs a ride to an AA meeting. Can you give her a lift to a meeting on Sunday night? And I said, sure. Now, by all rights, Debbie should have been driving, really. Debbie was Bob's widow, the fellow who drowned. And she had 22 days of sobriety, and I picked her up in my car. You know, I've been separated from my wife for about 11 minutes. And I come pulling up, and there's Debbie looking like $1 million. She got out of care unit. She looked like she'd been completely transformed from the inside out. And I pull up in my Volkswagen. It looked like I did. It had about, if you scratch the surface, there was very little left but primer on this thing. Headlights aiming at the raccoons in the trees that aren't there, and it was just a wreck. It didn't have a reverse on it, so I always had to park on a hill with no one in front of me so I could get it started in the morning, which seemed to me a lot easier than getting the transmission fixed, but you understand that. And so I said, okay, I'll give Debbie a ride to the meeting. So I went and picked her up and drove her to the meeting. We listened to Steely Dan on the stereo. And I pulled up in front of the meeting, and I didn't know it. And this is really important to hear if you're new. Debbie had 22 days of sobriety, and she 12-stepped me in that car on the way to this meeting because I told her that I'd quit drinking, like she had to guess. And so we pull up in front of the meeting, and I said, what time do you want me to come back and get you? And she said, why don't you come into the meeting with me? And I said, with a straight face, because I'm not an alcoholic. Really? As I adjusted my sunglasses for the nighttime meeting and pulled down my deerstalker hat that I was taken to wearing, she said something that just amazes me even today. She said, oh, you don't have to be an alcoholic. It's an open meeting. And since you quit this week, quit drinking, maybe you'll hear something that'll help you stay quit. And I thought, that sounds fair. I couldn't argue with that. Sounds fair to me. So I got out, parked the car with no one in front of me, and went into the meeting. And there were about 300 AA members in there, and I did not feel like I was home. I felt odd in there. I felt like I would just entered into a game of Loserama. Now I'm twitchy and in a deerstalker hat and sunglasses in the back of a nighttime meeting, you know, and getting annoyed when people were coming up going, are you new? And my reaction was, I am not new, thank you. I've got 4 days. I thought new meant that you had been drinking when you crossed the threshold coming into the room. I have 4 days. Those were the hardest 4 damn days of my life. So I would appreciate you not chuckling when I say I'm not new, I've got 4 days. That was hard, you know? And so they gave me phone numbers, and one woman said, you got a big book yet? And I thought, God. I don't know if I have a big book. I work in a bookstore. We got a lot of big books in there. Just how big a book are you talking about? Perhaps your big book has a title. I don't want to be too presumptuous here. I've already got a clear drink. So So she took me over to the literature table, and the woman there said, you need a big book? I thought, I suppose so. Someone said, she said, well, you know, it's $5 at the time. In 1981, it was $5. It's $6 now. Inflation's killing us. So she gave me the big book, and she said, here's the book. And I said, well, how much is it? And she goes, $5. And I said, you know, I took my money out, and I had $3 in my pocket. And I said, you know, I'll get it the next time I'm here, like never. And I started to put the money away, and she goes, that's okay. And I'll tell you what you do. Here you go. Give me $2. I'll take the $2. The book is yours. If you want to pay back the rest of the money, pay it back, please. But consider it your book and don't worry about it. And keep the other dollar and put it in the basket because you can't stay sober on somebody else's dime. And I thought, okay. So I got the big book and I walked away from that table and I felt worse than I felt when I went up there because I owed the IRS. I owed every credit card company in North America. I owed my ex-wife. I owed the man I worked for money. And now I'm into AA for $3. This is a pool that has no bottom here. I just keep swinging down and it keeps, you know. So I sat down and the speaker talked and the speaker, his name was Ron. And I'll never forget him because he was from San Pedro and he was a lawyer. That's all I know about him. I don't think I've ever seen him since then. And he gave a talk, though, and when he was talking, he talked about having his jaw wired shut in the Army because he got in a Jeep accident, flew over the top of the windshield and hit a tree, and it broke his jaw all to pieces. And he had it all wired shut, and he had a broken tooth in the front that he could sip booze through a straw. And somebody said to him, "You better not do that. Because if you drink too much and you get sick and you have to vomit, you're going to suffocate because your jaws are wired shut." And he said, from that point on, I always carried a pair of wire clippers in my hand. Now, let me explain something to you. Everybody in the room laughed just like that, except me. Because I was sitting there going, finally, I've been here 45 minutes to an hour. Finally, someone is saying something that makes some sense. They're not talking about their higher power and a big book and all this stuff and, you know, come up and get a chip and a hug. I don't want a chip and a hug. Unless you can slip me a 10 or 5 or something in there, I don't need a chip and a hug. My friend Eileen W. says she came to AA yelling, "Help me!" You know, and that's exactly what I was doing. I'm happy to hear what you think I should do, and I'll do anything to stay sober as long as I agree with it. And I was fighting everything in the room, and people didn't care. You know how that is. People, in fact, they gravitated toward me because I was so resistant to this. You know, I kind of laugh off everything. Oh, come over here. Why don't you come out for coffee with us? Oh, I don't think so. I got to take Debbie back. You know, and so that was my first experience at an AA meeting was hearing a guy who finally made some sense and everybody laughed at him. But Debbie said, "You got to come back next week because I'm getting a 30-day chip. And I want you to be here." Okay. So I picked her up again and drove her to the meeting and Debbie got her 30-day chip and a hug. And she sat down and she told me that if I stuck around for 30 days, that I could get a chip. And again, I thought, really? Now, at this point, I hadn't had a drink in about 2 weeks almost. And I was really ripe then. I mean, really ripe. And I just kind of scoffed at it. I was like in the doctor's opinion when the doctor said that, you know, you may have come here to scoff, but we hope you stay to pray or something to that effect. I was a scoffer. I scoffed the entire time. But fortunately enough for me, I didn't scoff so much that it was able to mask my desperation or mitigate it one degree because I was the same desperate guy and I knew that you had something that I didn't have and I didn't know if I wanted what you had, but I certainly didn't want what I had. And so I kept coming back. I went to the meeting every Sunday night, like a commitment. Every Sunday I was at that meeting. And Debbie took her chip that Sunday night, and then the following Tuesday she got drunk. And she didn't get back to AA for 9 years after that. And my reaction to her drinking when I was told that she went out and drank was, first I was shocked, and secondly I felt I'd been abandoned in AA, because she was the only person I knew in the room. And she left. And now, and this was the thinking, she gets to drink again. She got it, she got her chip, and now she gets to drink again. And there was something inside of me that I don't know where it came from that said, but you can't. I don't know what, that was the anchor inside of me that kept me here, was that feeling that she gets to drink again and I can't. Now, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And somebody said, well, you got to go to more meetings. I thought, I can only get to one meeting. You know, I can only get to Sunday night. I got a big card I've got full. You know, my dance card is way overloaded. That was a lie, but I was now in publishing. I had deadlines. I was a receiving clerk in a bookstore, and I was working there. And so I couldn't get to more meetings, and I went to a meeting one night, and a guy named Keith Carpenter was talking. And Keith gave a great talk, and the people there made me go up and thank him, you know. They were saying, get up and thank the speaker. And I go, well, and here's an interesting note. The third speaker I heard at that meeting was Chuck Chamberlain, and I didn't understand a word that man said. And he would giggle the whole time he was talking. You know, you see, half measures avail us nothing. You think half measures avail us 50%? They give you nothing. I'm looking at the people around me going, is anybody picking this up? And so they made me go up and thank Chuck. And I didn't want to thank, I didn't understand him. How am I going to thank him? For what? I'm sorry, I didn't understand you, but thank you. So I go up to him, and I get right up to him, and he said, he grabbed my hand, and he goes, how long are you sober? And I said, 20 days. And he goes, I love you. And he grabbed me, put his arms around me, and he kissed me right on the mouth. And that's where I caught alcoholism. From Chuck Chamberlain. I started to run a little fever that night, and the next day I was an alcoholic, I'll tell you. So I go back the next week, and it's Keith Carpenter. And Keith, they made me, you know, go up and thank Keith. So I go up and I thanked him like this. Keith said, how long are you sober? And I said, I don't know, 27 days, 20-something days. And he goes, how many meetings are you going to? I go, I go to 4. And he goes, you should be going to 7 meetings. And I said, you know, 4 meetings a month is about all I can handle. And he goes, I'm talking about 7 meetings a week. And I said, that's a lot of meetings. And he goes, how many nights did you drink? And I said, oh, okay, 7, I guess. And he said, I'll tell you what, here's a meeting. First he said, why don't you go to more meetings? And I said, because I have to drive home. I worked in Santa Monica, and I lived in Anaheim. It's about an hour drive. By the time I get home, it's 8:30, and the meetings have already started, and I can't walk in late. You know, because I've never done that before in my life. And he said, well, then here's a meeting that's right by where you work in Santa Monica. Why don't you come to this meeting? I got the address, you know, and I'm looking at it. And he goes, starts at 8:30. At the time, it started at 8:30. I'll be looking for you there. So that next Wednesday night, I had to go to the meeting because I knew this guy would be looking for me. So I show up at the meeting, you know, and I get there about 8:29 and sit in the back of the room. And I couldn't find Keith anywhere. But I sat next to this woman named Alice. I'll tell you a story about Alice. Alice, you guys know Alice. Alice was this little black lady who was... She was nuts. She was having Vietnam flashbacks, and she had never been to Vietnam. And she would tell me about them in these really, I mean, like street versions of it. I'm just, my hair's curling, my remaining hair. But so I'm sitting next to Alice, and Alice is sitting there at the break, and she goes, how long are you sober? And I went, I think I got 40 days now. And she had about 35, so she didn't like that at all. And she goes, you got a sponsor? And I said, no. She goes, you better get you one. I thought, well, I'll get me one when I'm ready to, thank you. Somebody had already suggested I get a sponsor. I said, what do I need a sponsor for? And they said, to help take you through the big book. Wow. Oh, I understand. This really deep metaphysical text. I need someone to help me with this. I graduated from college with a journalism major. I need someone to help me unlock the jaywalker analogy. Someone to really key me in to the double meaning of G-Ma, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing. Or give me three reasons why I should care about Mr. Brown. And if you don't know who Mr. Brown is, shame on you. So Alice is telling me again, you better get you a sponsor. And I say, yeah, I will. Where do you go to meetings? I said, I just go out, you know, mumble. And she said, you got something to write on? And I gave her a check deposit slip because I figured I wasn't going to be using that for a while. And on the back of this check deposit slip, in one of those drafting pens that has a point on it like a razor, like a needle point, she wrote the directions to every Pacific Group meeting from the driveway of where I worked. Monday through Sunday. Pull out of the driveway. She knew where I told her where I worked. She make a left on Monday night. Then you go down, you make another left on 20th Street. You drive all the way down 20th Street. And she gave me all the directions on here in this little deposit slip that I carried around in my wallet for about 6 months. I wish I had it. I tell you, I wish I had it. And she wrote it all down. So the next night I get out the deposit slip because a bunch of people came up to me at the Wednesday night meeting and they said, we'll see you tomorrow night. It's over at the Century Federal Building over in Santa Monica. Just be there. So I went to that meeting and people took me out for coffee and Alice was there. She kind of swung her way through the crowd, you know, surprising me. You know, here's Alice. And she goes, so, you get you a sponsor? I go, no, I don't have one yet. She goes, you better get one. Okay, Alice. So I went to the Friday night meeting, which was a men's stag, so I figured I was safe from Alice. And Saturday night, again, Alice slithering through the crowd, you know, and Sunday night. Well, the next Monday, I'm driving to work on the San Diego freeway, and I was moving along in a pretty good clip in this little Volkswagen, and the person in front of me just slammed their brakes on. I mean, just boom, like that. And I hit my brakes as hard as I could and went, and I thought, maybe this is working. Maybe this. And I looked in my rearview mirror, and the guy behind me is talking to somebody in his car. And he looks up, and boom! Just accordions my car into the car in front of me. He gets out. The other guy gets out. Neither of them speak English. I'm standing on the side of the road, and now I'm walking back and forth going, oh, man. Oh, man. You know, I'm feeling like a Rain Man. You know, I'm just going back. I couldn't think. I didn't know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do? I don't have any phone numbers. I didn't ask anybody for their phone numbers. I don't know what to do. I can't call. I'm stuck on the freeway. And now the freeway's all stopped because everybody's going by to see who the dingbat is that got accordioned in the accident. And I'm walking back and forth, and I'm sweating, and these two guys are arguing in Spanish, and I'm panicking. And I look up at the car, this wave of cars going by, the looky-loos are all going by, and in one of the cars is Alice waving. And I surrendered. I just thought, I give up, you know? And so within 2 days, I had a sponsor. This sponsor, I got this guy named Bill, who walked me through everything. He sat me down and said, if you want me to sponsor you, I have to give you some specific directions. And the first thing I want to ask you is, are you willing to do anything to stay sober? And I said, yes. And he said, you have to be willing to not argue with anything I ask you to do. Okay, and I said, sure. So he goes, okay, I want you to go to meetings. I want you to get there early. I want you to go to 7 meetings a night. I want you to get commitments at your meetings. I want you to read the big book, but not alone. Because he talked to me, and he apparently knew I would be arguing with it while I was reading it. So he said, read it, only read it at a book study when other alcoholics are around, because I don't want you looking at it by yourself. And I want you to go out for coffee with other alcoholics and get phone numbers from the guys and shake everybody, as many hands as you can shake, and ask people their name. man, because I don't want to shake hands. I don't like people. I want to be around here. Anyway, it's just really everything I can do to show up. And now you got me doing all this crap. Okay. I can do that. So I go back to the meeting. I gave him a schedule of the meetings I would go to. I'm going around shaking everybody's hand and all this nonsense. And lo and behold, I wasn't having a spiritual awakening really soon. I was a little annoyed because I was doing all this stuff. I had a coffee commitment. I cleaned the coffee pots. I didn't get to make them, make the coffee. I had a mopping commitment. I had an ashtray commitment. I had all these different commitments, and I was waiting for the steps to start. I said to Bill, when are we going to, at about 7 months, I said, when do we start doing the steps? I want to do the steps. I hear everybody else talking about it. I'm doing 3. I'm doing 4. Somebody spot me. I'm going to do a 5. It's just like they're doing some calisthenics. When are we going to start doing the steps? And he looked at me and he goes, what are you talking about? And I said, I want to do the steps. I've heard from people that the Pacific Group doesn't do the steps. And I'm starting to believe it. He said, wait, are you calling me every day? I said, yeah. And do you do what I ask you to do, right? You're going to meetings? Yeah. You shaking hands? Yeah. You getting phone numbers? Well, yeah. You calling other alcoholics during the day? Yeah, I call them. Just call them and ask how they're doing, like you said. You went out for coffee because I see you at coffee. You're doing your commitments. And do you like doing them? I said, not always. And he goes, well, what do you do the night you don't want to do them? And I said, well, I go do them because you said to do them, whether I like it or not. And he goes, what part of the first 3 steps do you think you're not doing? Because they're a lot more than theory, sport. They are tangible actions. You can't just sit around making a decision without taking an action afterward. Once you've made the decision that you want to stay sober, you have to do something. The steps are not meant to be set down and examined. They're meant to be used. They're utilized. And we got all kinds of AA in LA. We got steps where, meetings where they sit down and analyze the words and what Bill really meant by although. I'm not kidding you. Some of the meetings, it's just short of throwing down chicken bones and feathers. And woogie, boogie, boogie. Let's channel Dr. Bob. He was a god. He was a saint. Let's talk about his sainthood, Look at these guys. These are not saints. These are guys, If you want to nominate somebody for sainthood in AA, let's nominate that last guy Bob operated on before he got sober. I had a colonoscopy about a year ago, last thing I want to hear when I'm going under the anesthetic is the crack of a beer can. But these steps are meant to be used in AA where it's safe to screw them up, because you can't do them right in here. You can't do them right. If you say if anyone tells you they're doing the steps right, don't take a ride home with them. We all do them wrong. We are all immense failures at being humble and humbly asking and making adequate amends. Like, I'm sorry, what else do you want from me? But you know what? Even if you say that to somebody, like, I'm sorry I smashed your car, now what? That's not adequate. But you can do it again. And you do it again till you get it right. But there's no failure in here except drinking. There's no failure in AA except drinking. And even then, you can come back. We want you to come back. Just because you drank, I was secretary of a meeting our Pacific Group meeting a few years ago, and a woman came up to me and she said, Charlie, the man next to me has been drinking. And I thought, well, we're not going to let that element creep into our AA meeting. You let me handle this. We don't want any drunk people in our Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship. But you really can't screw this up here. And you know what? This is where we go to get the comfort and support that Sharon was talking about last night. That where else do you get somebody like Maurice Zolotow to comfort you? I went up to Maurice Zolotow, who was a well-esteemed writer in his day, and I went up to him, books with my bookstore apron on pretty much and said, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. And Maurice looked at me and said, then write something. And he turned around and walked away. That's like, I'm really feeling like staying sober. Then do something. What are you telling me for? I don't care what you intend to do. I want to hear what you did and how it worked out. I even want to hear if it didn't work out, because it's okay here. The fear of failure is powerless in here amongst other alcoholics, because we understand what you're doing and we understand why you're doing it and we understand what's at stake. And that's why we support everybody in here who's trying this thing. And I had I heard a woman a couple of months ago at our meeting who said, I'm an alcoholic, but my drug of choice is heroin. And I thought, you know, what's your drug of no choice? Because if it's not alcohol, you got nothing to say to me. Not that I have any disrespect for you, but I don't get it. I need to be where the primary purpose is people who drank like I did, who understand what's at stake for me. And it's not an us versus them mentality. It's just that I don't have any place else to go. This is my home. This is where I can safely screw up, and this is where people taught me how to get in touch with a higher power. And I'll tell you how. I did that, all those commitments for 8 months, doing it, and not having a spiritual awakening, not having one. And I heard some woman at a meeting get in. She came in one time, and she was, you know, I haven't been to a meeting in 7 months, but I came back today, and I had a spiritual awakening. I thought, what? I'm folding cords, mopping floors, emptying trash cans, cleaning out ashtrays, and I got nothing. This bitch comes back for one day and has a spiritual awakening. What kind of God is this? Where is this God? This isn't fair. You know? I went to Bill. I literally left work that day and went to see Bill and said, what is it? When am I going to have a spiritual awakening? A wise one. He was my spot. He said, I really don't know. I'll tell you one thing. If you keep doing what you're doing, it's going to happen, and you will not have any mistake about it when it does. Okay. So I continue to say my prayers. I continue to talk to my bedspread. I continue to surrender to a God I didn't believe in. I continue to do all this stuff, and Bill was right. One day I was standing at Ohio Street on a Sunday night mopping the floor with two other losers who were still sober, and mopping the floor, and I stopped for a second, and I was looking at the people lined up to thank the speaker, and there were about 100 people in line. And I was looking at their, just standing, thinking of nothing, just kind of stopped for a second. And I'm looking at the people across, looking at the faces in the line. And it occurred to me here, not up here, but right down here, that I knew every single one of them by name. And I liked them. What a shock for someone who doesn't like people and who doesn't want to be involved. And I felt as comfortable and as full of hope as I've ever felt in my life in the midst of these people standing with a mop in my hand. And I thought, if I could be transported to any other place in the world right now, I wouldn't go. I just want to stand here and feel this feeling forever, forever. And I left and I called Bill and told him what happened. And he said, you had a moment of grace. That's what a moment of grace feels like. Don't forget that, because you're going to find more if you keep opening yourself up to them. You know, and I did. And I did all the steps. I did an inventory with Bill. I read it. Bill walked me through my divorce. He walked me through, a lot of different problems I was having, a lot of different things that seemed catastrophic at the time that now seem like footnotes in a life. And like they teach us in AA, you know, your life starts to get better and bigger if you just stop being afraid of what's happening. And I wound up applying to be a teacher because it was offered to me, and I didn't want to take it. I wanted to talk to somebody about it first. I wanted to take the job, but I couldn't. So I called Bill and said, someone offered me a job to teach at this college, teach English. And I was in grad school because he'd asked me to go back to grad school so I could have the freedom to complain about my current job. And so I did. And he said, if you want to do better, take the job. And I said, well, I thought I'd stay in school for about a year and really get to know my subject better. And then all I heard was, So I went back and said, okay, I'll take the job. And I became a teacher at Santa Monica College, and where I worked in the bookstores in the morning and taught English part of the time. And then the next year I applied to be a teacher at a Catholic school. I wound up being a high school teacher, and I did that for 7 years. And my the fear of doing when I before I went in to teach high school kids, I was terrified. And I'm sitting in my house, my apartment one night, and Bill called and said, "When do you start?" And I said, "Tomorrow." And he goes, "Let me come over, I'll talk to you." So he comes over and he says, "Get some coffee." That was always his direction, get some coffee. So we got some coffee and he sat down and he said, "I bet you're really afraid." And I said, "Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable." He goes, "Those kids could eat you alive." Yeah, that's what I've heard. He says, "You may go in there tomorrow and find out that you really should not be a teacher." I thought, "Yeah." He said that, or you can choose not to do it and wonder if you could when you're 70 years old. How do you want to live your life? He said, "When you go in that classroom tomorrow, you've got everybody in our group, everybody in AA who knows you with their hand at the small of your back. When you go up there to face those kids, that's what brought you to that moment. That's why you're there. It's not you. It's grace that's brought you there. So go in there with the comfort of grace and don't be afraid." And I went in and did that. I did it for 7 years. I love these kids. I love these high school kids. I thought, you know, I've got some of them as Facebook friends now. They sought me out. They're in their 40s now, some of them. And it's just, you know, their life, I didn't ruin them that much. And then I got an opportunity to write for a living, and I took it. And I started doing things differently. And I was afraid the whole time. I was terrified the whole time. But as I was taught by my sponsor and by Alcoholics Anonymous and by doing the steps, that the fear is egotistical. It's just a sense that I might not get something that I want, or I might get something that I don't want, and just ignore it and walk through it. So I would just have to literally force myself into doing it. And I wound up becoming a book editor and writer. And I worked with a guy who I idolized as a kid. I idolized this guy who was a director, and I wound up getting a call that he needed someone to help him edit a book. And they called my office and said, "Would you go over and work with this guy on this thing?" And I thought, okay. So I went over, what am I going to tell this guy? He was 85 years old. He had an Academy Award. He was a legend. And I'm sitting down talking to him, and we had a really nice meeting, and he was very nice to me. And I got up, and I walked out of there, and I'm walking across, going back to my office, and I'm dressed in a suit and tie, and I'm feeling comfortable, and I'm feeling even with the world, and I'm feeling like there's no way that I could have gotten here. It occurred to me that if I could have seen myself walking across this place right now, dressed as I am, if you could take this scene and shoot it back to me 30 years and show me what I was going to be 30 years from now, I would have screwed it up because I would have been trying to get there. And I can't get there from here. I have to be led there from here. My mother always told me when I was lost in the store, she said, "If you ever get lost in the store, stand in one place and I will find you. If you keep running around looking for me, we're going to miss each other, but you stay in one place and I will come find you." And the same thing applies to my spiritual life. I can't go shooting around looking for God in everything. When I'm in crisis and I need God's help, I have to sit still and hope that he finds me, that I can clear out enough of the resistance to just do it. And sometimes that clearing out and sometimes that relief from resistance comes from you. It doesn't come from some big thing that comes down from the sky. It comes from people in AA who go, let me share something about my life that I did with that. And it changes, you know. I got laid off 4 years ago. And despite the fact that the world is clamoring for 55-year-old men, I started working freelance. I'm doing it. I don't know how. I'm terrified, but I'm doing it. And I met a woman, and I got married, and that failed miserably. And I have these two beautiful children. I just take a couple of seconds because I know I kind of blabbed on. But my kids have had a tough time in the last year. Their mom was sober in AA for a while. And she, a year ago last April, she drank after 15 years of not drinking and tried to commit suicide. So I got them overnight full-time as a single dad at the time. And Louise stepped right in. My girlfriend stepped in, and she just really, you know, got right behind me and said, "This is going to be okay. You're going to work this out." And we got things organized. I had people in AA coming out of the woodwork. Just like, I'll tell you, Sharon was one of the people that saved my bacon during my divorce, because I came to a meeting one night and I was going to kill this woman. I was just fit to kill. And I came to our Saturday night meeting. I don't know why I came. I just walked in there, and my eyes were spinning like cheap fireworks, you know. And I go in there, and there's Sharon. And she walks across the room, and she goes, "Why don't we go for a walk?" And she looped her arm around mine, and we just went for a walk around the block. And I just told her what was going on. And I knew Sharon had been through this with a previous husband and had walked through it. And I just needed somebody to hang on to, just to hang on to. And Sharon was the one. And another thing that Sharon did for me was that she taught me how to make amends to my mother in the same way that she made amends to her dad. I did it. I followed. She didn't tell me directly. She spoke at a meeting, and I heard her say it. And I tried to do it with my mom. And I did the exact same thing, except I didn't notify my mother because I'd made announcements to her before that I hadn't followed through on. I paid her back all of her money in the same way you did. I sent her a note every week the same way you did. And I wound up being the executor of my mom's will when she died. And I'm not the kind of guy that you want to entrust any money to, you know? My mother and I had a great relationship when she died, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program that I was given from someone like Sharon. So anyway, I have my children now. I'm remarried, and my wife and I have a good sober home, and my life is good. And I'll tell you something. I know there are a lot of people in here right now who are afraid, and I know that there are a lot of people in here who are suffering, and I know there are a lot of people here who are looking for something to try to take away whatever it is they're experiencing right now. The answer is the person sitting next to you. The answer is the person in the hallway. The answer is in some of the meetings. The answer is at coffee. The answer is all around you. I heard a woman at the International Convention in San Diego one time standing on the street screaming, "I don't want to miss my bus to the meeting, and I'm trying to get to all these meetings, and I can't get to every single workshop I want to go to, and I feel like I'm missing the convention." And a guy yelled, "This is the convention." Right here on the street, talking to each other, have some coffee. Welcome to AA. Let's have a meeting. Thanks for having me. I'm grateful to be here. Thanks a lot.